Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. Newsmakers from America and around the world speak with journalists in an unscripted and unrehearsed discussion about the critical issues facing the United States and the world. Here is your host on this edition of Press Conference USA, Carol Castiel.
Welcome to Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. Joining me on the program is Leo Kayan, chief of VOA's House of Service. Our guest on this edition of the program is Ambassador John Campbell, former U.S. ambassador to Nigeria, currently the Ralph Bunche Senior Fellow for Africa Policy Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations here in Washington. Our topic, turmoil in Nigeria, as the terrorist group Boko Haram continues to gain prominence and threaten the country. The group has been blamed for thousands of deaths during its five-year insurgency in Nigeria. It has seized towns in Borno and Adamawa states for what it calls a caliphate, to be ruled under strict Islamic law. Ambassador Campbell is the author of a recently released report entitled U.S. Policy to Counter Nigeria's Boko Haram. He concludes that better governance, not force, is the most effective tool to fight Boko Haram. Ambassador Campbell has had a long and distinguished career as a U.S. diplomat. He served as ambassador to Nigeria from 2004 to 2007. He also served in South Africa and has taught international relations at the University of Wisconsin. Ambassador Campbell is the author of Nigeria, Dancing on the Brink, and he writes the blog Africa in Transition. We'll talk with him about the findings in his report, U.S. Policy to Counter Nigeria's Boko Haram, among other related topics. Ambassador Campbell joins us here at the VOA Broadcast Center in Washington. Welcome to the program.
Thank you very much. It's good to be with you.
I'm delighted to welcome my colleague, Leo Kayan, from the House of Service. Well, Mr. Ambassador, let's get right to your report by way of talking more about how the threat from Boko Haram has continued to actually grow. And you say that the insurgency is a direct result of chronic poor governance by Nigeria's federal and state governments, the political marginalization of northeastern Nigeria, and the region's accelerating impoverishment, and that rather than fighting the militant group solely through military force, that the U.S. and Nigerian governments must work together to redress alienation of Nigeria's Muslims. Talk a little bit more about your thesis.
Thank you very much. Northern Nigeria in general, and particularly northeastern Nigeria, has been on a downward spiral for a long time. The coming of the oil economy to Nigeria sucked up investment from other sectors of the economy. And in the North, it was particularly devastating. For example, the North at the time of independence was a major food exporter to all of West Africa. Nigeria is now a net importer of food. There was a very large cotton-growing industry that's gone, and there was also an important textile industry centered particularly in the towns of Kano and Kaduna that also is largely gone. In addition, the social statistics for northern Nigeria are dramatically worse than they are for the rest of the country. For example, in much of the north, the female literacy rate is only about 20%. The average woman will give birth to somewhere between 7 and 8 children. So there are real demographic pressures in the north. Climate change is also impacting on the north. As the Sahara creeps south, pastures disappear, forcing migratory peoples, such as the Hausa Fulani, to move their herds further south, where very often they collide with farmers, many of whom are Christian. And then there has been a chronic pattern of both poor governance, but also basically officially ignoring the Northeast. This is very long-standing. This dates back really to colonial times. There's nothing particularly new about it, but it has cumulative effects. Historically, a way Nigeria managed the fact that the northern half of the country is predominantly Muslim and the southern half of the country is predominantly Christian. Historically, a way that was managed was through a form of power alternation. That ended in 2011 when Goodluck Jonathan, a southern Christian, ran for the presidency even though the north regarded it was its turn, and Jonathan won. That added a certain edge to the general alienation. We cannot say that that caused Boko Haram, Boko Haram has been there in one form or another since about 2002 or 2003, and it draws on very deep roots, but it added an edge to the sense of alienation.
Well, that's a terrific background. So let me ask you now, in terms of the Nigerian government and its strategy to combat Boko Haram, what progress, if any, has the Nigerian government made in quelling this insurgency, whether militarily or, as you indicate, through providing greater economic and educational opportunities in the north?
Very little. The Nigerian government's response to Boko Haram has been to treat it not as an insurgency with some popular roots, but rather as a form or branch of international terrorism. President Jonathan even characterized it that way last spring in April, when he said that Boko Haram in northern Nigeria is the latest front in the international war on terrorism, and that, therefore, the international community should get involved. The security forces have, according to sources such as the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, and a host of credible Nigerian and foreign non-governmental organizations, done a huge number of human rights violations. Huge. What the human rights violations that are done by the security services, what that does is it tends to drive popular support into Boko Haram.
Exactly. Well, I was going to ask you about that. In addition to the local grievances, economic and otherwise, to what extent have the heavy-handed tactics by the Nigerian security forces actually fueled the rise?
There's plenty of anecdotal evidence that those human rights abuses are one of the drivers of support for Boko Haram, at least in certain areas.
Now let me turn to my colleague Leo for a question from the House of Service.
I hear people talk about the military adding more petrol to fire in the way they treat Boko Haram. But you see, this is partly driven by the fact that Boko Haram itself is merciless. It has no human element at all. And the way they kill everybody, Muslims, Christians, children, women, everybody, how do you think the military would treat these people?
The difficulty is that, from a military perspective, is that adherents to Boko Haram are very difficult to identify. They simply look like the general population. So that if, for example, a car bomb goes off in a market, it's very hard for the military or the police to know who is Boko Haram and who is not. Their response tends to be to simply round up all males between the ages of about 16 and 30 and hold them in detention indefinitely. Part of this is a training issue. Part of it is also a cultural difference. The military in Nigeria are a national force, and so the soldiers and police who are involved can come from all over the country, may or may not know the local languages, may or may not know the local customs. So it's easy to see how they respond the way they do. It's also well known that Boko Haram will literally kill any soldier or policeman that falls into its hands. It's easy to understand, but it's also dysfunctional in terms of sucking the oxygen out of Boko Haram. Mm-hmm. In other words, we should certainly condemn the human rights abuses, even if we understand where they come from, particularly in individual cases. But we should also acknowledge and recognize that the human rights abuses are one of the causes for Boko Haram's rather remarkable growth.
Well, speaking of its remarkable growth, Ambassador, talk about where we are today. They seem to have morphed into a much more potent organization. They have relationships, if I'm not mistaken, with other al-Qaeda affiliates. What are the relationships between Boko Haram and these other international Islamist organizations?
It's very much an issue of debate amongst people who watch these kinds of questions. There are really two schools. One would maintain that, as the Nigerian government says, Boko Haram has become another front in the international war on terrorism. The other school is that Boko Haram is overwhelmingly of indigenous nature, and that while it may have links of some sort with other international terrorist groups, they are not transformative. Part of the difficulty here is, what is Boko Haram? Boko Haram is, in my view, a highly diffuse grassroots rebellion against the Nigerian political economy, and as such, it is not centralized. The face of Boko Haram, from an American perspective, tends to be a figure that we call Abubakar Shekau. He is the person who has released videos. It looks as though he, if he exists at all, and I'll talk about that in a minute, he has operational control only over one faction. Over the past week or so, there has been a burst of terrorist activity in Kano. It doesn't look to me like the terrorism that's going on in Kano is the same as the terrorism that has been associated with Abubakar Shekau. For one thing, Shekau has not claimed responsibility for it. But let me back up here for just a moment. I said, or implied, that there's a question as to whether Abubakar Shekau exists. He was last seen in 2009. At the time, the military said that they had killed him. There have been periodic reports since of his having been killed. In the videos that Boko Haram has released, in which Abubakar Shekau is the chief speaker, it looks like at times it's not the same person. People pore over these videos trying to determine whether it is. Further, there is a precedent for a kind of composite identity. That comes from the movement for the emancipation of the Niger Delta, where there was a figure called Jomo Momo, who was apparently a composite figure, didn't really exist. One of the really interesting things about Boko Haram is how little we actually know about it, so that we don't really know if Abubakar Shekau exists, what kind of organizational structure he has, what kind of influence he has over other parts of this kind of grassroots insurgency.
Why do you think that Boko Haram is holding on to local governments in Borno State and some local governments in Adamawa State? So far, they have established some territorial gains, and they're trying to govern now. Is that not some level of sophistication?
It's a very interesting development. This Abubakar Shekau figure has proclaimed a caliphate in northeastern Nigeria, and that becomes a defined piece of territory in which certain government services have to be provided. We know remarkably little about what is actually going on in the territories that Boko Haram controls. No Western diplomats can go there. No Western journalists can go there. The Nigerian press is extremely restricted in what it can do. But for those who do have contact with the areas that Boko Haram controls, what tends to come out is that Boko Haram is able to reimpose a degree of security so the shops open and disputes are dealt with according to Sharia law. But we don't know much more than that.
We'll have more in just a moment, but first you're listening to Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. Our guest is Ambassador John Campbell, former U.S. Ambassador to Nigeria, currently the Ralph Bunch Senior Fellow for Africa Policy Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations. Here in Washington, we're talking about how to counter the threat from Boko Haram in Nigeria. And joining me on the program is Leo Kayan, Chief of VOA's House of Service. And I'm Carol Castiel. This is a reminder that our PCUSA podcast is available for free download on iTunes. You can find the download by clicking on the iTunes tab on our website, voanews.com/PCUSA. You may also follow me on Twitter at Carol Castiel, VOA, or connect with us on Facebook. Please send your feedback to PCUSA@voanews.com as well. Tell us where you're from and how you listen to PCUSA. Here's a shout-out to Bright Izocha, a new listener from River State in Nigeria. Well, back to you, Ambassador John Campbell, talking about Boko Haram. Something led me to ask you about the role of women and girls. One, there's the terrible capture of these schoolgirls back in April, the hashtag Bring Back Our Girls. Up until now, we haven't brought back the girls. The government said that it had an agreement with Boko Haram to so-called bring them back. It seems to have been a false alarm. What do we make of this?
I think the first point we have to make is that kidnapping has been ongoing, and it continues right on up to the present time. What was surprising about the Chibok girls' kidnapping were the sheer numbers of them. But even a few weeks ago, 50 or 60 girls were kidnapped. So the numbers are really very large. When Boko Haram attacks a secular school, the pattern has been that the girls are kidnapped and the boys are all killed. Now, the fate of the girls is unknown. I would suspect that a good many of them are being used for domestic purposes, and some are no doubt sold off as brides. There has also been speculation that some of the female suicide bombers that have appeared, especially over the past several months, might be kidnapped girls, but we don't really know.
Very good point, because I was going to ask you about them and to what extent there's a relationship between this new phenomenon of female suicide bombers.
Yes. And it's very new. Suicide is basically anathema in West Africa. There is no tradition of it. It's not like the Middle East. That came into Nigeria only about 2011. It's a new thing.
It's new. That's why we are now trying to go after the recruitment. But Ambassador, would you think that suicide bombing by girls has any place in religion?
For me, no, certainly not. But I am not...
Is this part of the new tactics or whatever they are learning from Al-Qaeda and the rest of them?
I don't know where they're getting it from. For me, suicide bombing obviously has no place in religion, nor does murder. However...
What of martyrdom? That's the kind of thing I hear they tell them.
Yes, and martyrdom, I think, plays a role in it. Suicide, terrorism, martyrdom, it plays a role in religion in some places, but it never existed in West Africa.
Right? And I think it is important to say that even though Islamist groups use this tactic, it has no place in the Quran. I mean, there's no mention in Islam. I mean, it's haram, you know, anathema to kill oneself.
It depends on which Islamic scholar you are following. Boko Haram appears to have been greatly influenced by two 13th century theologians who were active in what is now Saudi Arabia. At the time of the Mongol destruction of the Islamic Empire in Baghdad, and the theological constructs that Boko Haram uses seem to be based on their thinking. It's very different from the broadly tolerant Sufism that traditional Northern Islam has been shaped by. It's very different from that. And it does not fall or fit into a Sunni versus Shia approach to Islam.
Well, that leads me to ask you something, Ambassador Campbell, and that is, to what extent do you think Saudi influence has affected not just Boko Haram and their tactics, but all of northern Nigeria and other Muslim countries in northwestern Africa, which have this much more tolerant Sufi, Maliki tradition, which is totally Islamic. It's not some deviant, you know, form of Islam. To what extent petrodollars, building of mosques, and some kind of a quid pro quo that the Saudis are extracting from the locals for whom they build these mosques is at play here?
I wouldn't call it so much Saudi as Wahhabist, of Saudi origin, of course. Certainly, it's played a major role. Lots of Wahhabist missionary activity in northern Nigeria going back, again, not all that far, about 30 years.
Exactly.
Further, an increase in the number of northern Nigerians who go on a pilgrimage to Mecca, which means they come into contact with Wahhabism. I think you can make a case that more Nigerians have studied in Saudi Arabia over the past few years than used to be the case. There's definitely linkages there. What I think we have to be careful of is to make a distinction between various brotherhoods and other organizations and the Saudi government.
Exactly. I have a question I'd like to pose from one of our listeners, Igwe Osaji from Nigeria. And this is in the context of this recent deal that the Nigerian government recently requested Cobra attack helicopters from the United States, but the U.S. rejected this request, so they turned to Russia to buy heavier weapons. So the listener says, why is the United States government refusing arms to Nigeria in view of the devastating effect that are often the byproduct of Boko Haram's attacks? Don't you think improved security weapons would go a long way in curbing this menace?
I think the question has to be addressed on two levels. First of all, I don't think it is possible to crush or destroy Boko Haram using military methods. I think essentially what is called for is not counterterrorism, but counterinsurgency. Essentially, if you like, a broad-based political program to address the alienation in parts of the North that underpins Boko Haram. So in other words, I think the strategy is wrong. The second point is the United States is limited by law in terms of arms sales, specifically the Leahy Amendment. The Leahy Amendment, which is a matter of U.S. law, states that arms sales or other forms of military assistance to military units is suspended if there are credible accusations of human rights violations, unless or until the host government investigates those allegations, prosecutes, tries, and punishes the perpetrators of them. That has not happened in northern Nigeria, and very few units of the Nigerian military can now pass the Leahy vetting.
All right, and before I turn to Leo for another question, a quick follow-up, which is with respect to this arms deal with Russia now, since the Nigerians turned to them because the United States had to reject their request. Does that portend anything in particular, the fact that Nigerians are turning to Russia? Does it weaken U.S.-Nigerian relations? Should we be worried about that?
I think it's easy to overstate its significance. I think from the Russian perspective, this is a straight commercial transaction. And the Russians, for that matter, like American arms manufacturers, are perfectly happy to sell weapons whenever and wherever they can.
Especially when there are no strings attached.
Exactly. I very much doubt that it will be particularly transformative.
Yeah, Ambassador, can we take a look at this? The Nigerian government is saying that for you to train its soldiers in human rights abuses in a time of war when Boko Haram is encroaching on territory is not reasonable. How would you expect this training to go on in the same barracks where people are being trained to go and confront Boko Haram or to stand the threat of Boko Haram approaching? This is what they are saying. They cannot be trained during war. They need to go attack and counter the terrorists. It's a difficult situation, isn't it?
It's a difficult situation, but American law is really very clear. Now, a question that I would have is why hasn't the Nigerian government investigated some of the credible accusations of human rights violations by the security services?
Clearly, you know, they will be indicted, and it doesn't help them during the war. So what are they going to do?
They might or might not be indicted, but you don't know unless or until there is an actual investigation. And so far as I can tell, the Nigerian government is simply stonewalled on that point.
And as the ambassador said, combating Boko Haram entails much more than counterterrorism.
Yeah.
It's more of a counterinsurgency.
Yeah.
And this whole addressing the root grievances, which help to fuel the likes of Boko Haram.
We should probably put on the table a proposal advanced last spring by Sambo Dasuki, who's a national security advisor. That proposal is a remarkably comprehensive approach to a counterinsurgency approach as opposed to a counterterrorism approach. Certain aspects of it are slowly being implemented. The trouble is, it takes a long time. You don't get immediate results.
In the few minutes we have left, Mr. Ambassador, where do you think we go from here, and how is the United States assisting Nigeria? Is there a role, a greater role for the United States to play, or the international community, notwithstanding this threat is not international terrorism per se, but to what extent can all actors, both within and outside of Nigeria, help the Nigerian government to reformulate its tactics, strategy, to actually combat this threat?
Looking forward, let me just add this quickly.
Sure.
I was just watching Buhari accept his primary elections result. He won the APC primary. Mm-hmm. Now he's going to face Goodluck Jonathan. People in Nigeria think that this government is not serious. That's why they've not been able to defeat Boko Haram. Do you think, with the kind of resolve and past experience and being a Muslim in northern Nigeria, you think Buhari is going to make a difference?
It's a very interesting question. It's also a very interesting question as to whether Buhari can command sufficient support in the southern and western parts of the country to meet the constitutional requirements for election. I just don't know.
So we are talking about the February
elections
in 2015 in Buhari, the complete name for those who may not have
Muhammadu
heard of him.
Muhammadu Buhari.
He was formerly a military chief of state, Nigeria, in the 1970s. The particular period, however, that he was military chief of state is remembered as being one of a remarkable reduction in corruption. And that's part of the basis for his popularity on the street.
And the development of public infrastructure as well.
He was also an effective minister of petroleum at one point.
Yeah.
He has a very good reputation. I would also point out that certain people in the South often will say that Buhari is an Islamic extremist. Far from that. He is a person of faith, but he's no extremist. But the question was where and how the U.S. could assist Nigeria. In the military area, it's difficult. And in fact, a very small military training program that we had involving a new military unit, therefore not one that was tinged by human rights accusations, that was unilaterally ended by the Nigerian government last week with no particular explanation for it. What is ongoing is the support we are providing for the elections process, since clearly if Nigeria is to move forward, if there is to be a counterinsurgency solution as opposed to a counterterrorism solution, elections which are regarded as credible will make that easier.
And do you think Muhammad Buhari has a chance against Goodluck Jonathan?
Given the fact that for the first time, the West is coming in with a full complement of its votes, and the East is also chipping in about half of its votes for the APC. That's the All Progressives Congress.
Yeah, perhaps. But the incumbent in Nigerian presidential elections always has an immense advantage. Further, it's very difficult for me to see how in the states of Borno, Yobe, and Adamawa, there can be a successful election. And those three states historically have supported the previous versions of the APC.
They're all APC states today.
And that's because of the insurgency.
Because of the insurgency.
Yeah.
And Boko Haram, I think, is really quite clear. It will do everything it can to disrupt elections. Because elections are a participation in the secular government, which from Boko Haram's perspective is evil.
Nigeria doesn't even exist in their dictionary.
No, it does not.
All right. Well, we'll have to leave that for another program. We look forward to having you back, Mr. Ambassador, perhaps right before the elections next year. Ambassador John Campbell is former U.S. Ambassador to Nigeria. He's currently the Ralph Bunch Senior Fellow for Africa Policy Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations. Press Conference USA on the Voice of America was produced in Washington. Thanks to Anna Zalewski for booking our guest. Our engineer was Nashwan Kali, and joining me on the program was Leo Kayan. He's chief of VOA's Hausa service. And I'm Carol Castiel. Join me again next week for another Press Conference USA on the Voice of America.
Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. From Washington, D.C., the nation's capital, the Voice of America has brought you Press Conference USA. You can email your questions or comments about this edition of Press Conference USA to pcusa@voanews.com. And to keep up with all the latest news, tune to the Voice of America on radio, television, or the World Wide Web. Join us again next week when another newsmaker speaks with journalists about the critical issues facing the United States and the world. We'll see you next week for another edition of Press Conference USA on the Voice of America.